John DeMarco was born in Florida into a family of New York transplants and grew up a diehard Mets fan, even from Florida. As a toddler, he watched the original Ghostbusters on a loop every day until the tape was reduced to dust. For show and tell in preschool, he proudly took his beloved VHS copy of The Land Before Time. John studied film at North Carolina State University, where he was also a member of the baseball team. Upon graduation in 2009, he started a summer internship program at Sportsnet New York, fetching coffee and hot dogs for his mentor and TV titan Bill Webb. After earning a coveted permanent position, he moved his way up the ladder from production assistant to associate producer to associate director to, for the last three seasons, the lead director. The New York Times did a profile of John last year and about the team over there at SNY, and they called what they do bracingly original. Surely there are some Mets fans here that do watch that broadcast, and it is certainly the case. There's nothing like a New York Mets broadcast. Behind the camera and in front of the camera, or audio, you know, sort of whether you can hear them or not, the booth team is certainly the best I think there is by far, and the team behind the scenes led by John DeMarco is also incomparable. The formal innovations that that John has brought to bear are really equate what he's doing with cinema, so today's program really is about embracing that, this notion of baseball is cinema, and also like putting together the baseball film and the Hollywood film and the dialogue that happens between them. We showed Major League this afternoon, and Major League has had like a real world effect on actual sports play. People reference Major League all the time. Wild Thing still gets played as like a reliever choice coming out of the pen. And then, of course, things like The Untouchables and Brian De Palma makes its way into a lot of what John DeMarco does, which we were going to talk about very, very shortly. It is my great pleasure to introduce to Museum of the Moving Image, John DeMarco.
Wow. There's a lot of you here. Wow. Thank you for the rain out, and thank you for being here. Wow, Eric, I was just thinking back there, we really missed an opportunity for my entrance here. We should have had Timmy Trumpet waiting, right? You know. Oh, wow, thank you guys so much for being here. Whoops, sorry about that. It's I'm so honored that I was asked to do this. This is so special for me. I grew up with two equal loves, baseball and movies, and this has just been an overwhelming year for me, and a lot of that's thanks to you guys. You guys have really embraced everything I've done, and it's been really totally unexpected. Like, you know, if you told me a year and a half ago that one August day, you know, Jacob DeGrom, you know, coming out to Simple Man and Edwin Diaz coming out to some crazy trumpet song was going to change my life, I'd be call you nuts, but it kind of did. You know, these three walls and the silver screen have always been a very safe place for me. I'm feeling a little vulnerable tonight. This is a little different for me. I'm usually in a dark truck, you know, staring at a bunch of screens, and you guys are watching my stuff. Now I have to look you in the eye, which is a little, it's a little different for me. But the thesis for tonight is baseball is cinema. I can't repeat that enough. Baseball is cinema. There's a lot of very smart people who rack their collective brains over at MLB headquarters, trying to figure out the next way to recapture their once mighty audience. They've promoted advanced analytics, superimposed live betting odds onto the screen, and this season rewrote the rules to a game that have been in place for over a century. The sooner baseball realizes that their competition is not the NBA or the NFL, but the content on Netflix, Hulu, HBO, and Amazon, and even your local theaters, places like this, the sooner they'll be able to recapture the title as the national pastime. But baseball isn't content. Baseball is so much more than that. Baseball is cinema. In the short film you're about to watch, you'll see clips from our Mets broadcast paired with some of the films that have served as an inspiration for me. All the cinematic flares that I've introduced over the last year and a half are going to be interspliced with stuff that, you know, has really made an impact on my life and inspired me to, you know, kind of bring it into your living rooms every night. Yeah, I'm pulling a Tarantino. It's inspiration. It's not stealing, okay? In the audience, you guys, I really don't take you for granted. out of all the things you could be doing every night at 7 o'clock, you guys choose to invite Gary, Keith, Ron, Steve, myself, and the rest of our crew into your homes. And I'll be damned if I'm not going to make it the best possible broadcast, because I know you guys have options. I'm so thrilled to, you know, do the things that I do for a living, because I genuinely look forward to coming to work every single day. You know, the games used to be 3 hours. They're more like 2.5 now with the pitch clock. But thank you for those 2.5 hours. There's an old adage in the TV business that the broadcast should be invisible in sports. We're there to document an event. In some ways, there's a lot of truth to that. But like one of the great visual storytellers of all time, Brian De Palma, whose Untouchables played earlier today, I have no interest in an unbiased point-and-shoot style of production. I want to use the medium to enhance the experience for the viewers at home. I want you guys to have FOMO when you go to the games, that you're missing something on SMY, whether it be Gary, Keith, and Ron, or some of the cool stuff we're doing behind the scenes. I want you guys to miss it. DVR it, I guess. But, you know, if I'm going to call attention to myself and the medium, I want to show you guys something a little different from time to time. I'm really trying to find a voice that you guys haven't seen before in this medium and in sports television in general. Like a sculptor with a block of marble or a slab of wood, the beauty is already in there. The game is beautiful. You guys know that. The game is perfect. You know, I'm scraping away at the exterior while revealing the game's inherent beauty for you guys at home. All the broadcasts get the same slab of wood. There's 29 other regional broadcasts, all the Foxes and ESPNs of the world. They get the same block of wood. I just happen to whittle a little more than most. So without further ado, baseball is cinema.
And just one little note, this is, we're watching a work of cinema, so please treat this as such, no phones for the next several minutes, and just enjoy, and we'll see you on stage in a little bit.
That's a big screen.
It looks fantastic up there. Yeah, I mean, so in case you hadn't entirely gotten that from this, of course, piece that was edited later, most of, if not all of what we're seeing you do in the game is done live, is edited live.
Yes, everything is done live. Is this thing on?
Yeah.
Okay. Everything's done live. I wish I could do it in post-production and make the games perfect, but unfortunately, we play every day, so I don't have any time for that.
Now, I want to get into the details of what we just saw and into the details of what your broadcasts are like and how they're made, but I also know that you get to talk about baseball every day. You don't get to talk about film every day, so let's talk about film a little bit.
Sure.
Let's begin with your relationship to cinema. In the bio, of course, we know about your relationship to Ghostbusters and Land Before Time, but I'm curious about, like, what, where the love began.
Yeah, it's like you read, it's been since day one. We've always had a cabinet full of VHS tapes at my house, you know, growing up. And, you know, as a teenager, it was kind of right in the middle of the DVD stage of everything. And those DVDs have special features. And so once I started watching those behind the scenes clips on those DVDs, it sort of ignited my passion for, you know, maybe making it a career one day. And I went to school at North Carolina State, and they had a film program. And so I dove headfirst into that, and I really thought I was going to be in, you know, somewhere in the industry. You know, I did some film festivals at school, and it was something that really excited me. But my girlfriend at the time in college, she was like, "What, are you going to move to Hollywood? Like, what's your plan here?" She was like, "Maybe, you know," she lived in New York. I had been to New York like twice in my life. She was like, "You like watching the Met games? Why don't you intern for SNY?" I was like, "Yeah, you think I should do that?" She was like, "Yeah, you should definitely try it." So I applied for SMY, you know, the internship, and they were like, "Oh, you're too late. Sorry, summer internships are all filled up." I was like, "Please, just stick me anywhere. Stick me in social media. I don't even know what that is. It's 2009." Fortunately, they passed my resume onto the folks in remote productions. I had no idea what that meant. My first day, I was told to go to the truck at Citi Field. I didn't know what that meant. Citi Field was brand new. So I showed up at the truck, and I walked in, and I watched one half inning, and I fell in love. And I knew that I was in the right place, and I really the pieces fell into the right spots for a reason, and this is what I was meant to do.
In school, did you do anything like that in terms of?
There was one TV production class that I took my final semester post internship. So I had no TV experience whatsoever prior to the internship.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So what about what you saw in that half inning did it for you?
It was an overwhelming, visceral sensation of looking at the monitor wall where all of the cameras are, seeing the shots that I've been watching my entire life being put together and pieced together to tell a story. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was watching a titan in the industry do it every single day, Bill Webb. He more or less invented the way that you all perceive television, baseball on television anyway. Nightly, he's the first guy to introduce low cameras near the dugouts. He's the first guy to really try to build that emotion that you guys have, you know, that I tried to accomplish in, you know, implementing some cinematic techniques. But he was really the first one who would take that shot of Andy Pettit with the eyes looking over the glove, or, you know, getting Curt Schilling's bloody sock and really starting to, you know, plant those seeds early on and, you know, let the narrative evolve and really using the players, the managers as characters in his own film. And that was something that was really exciting for me coming from my background in baseball and film. So it was a no-brainer.
I mean, just a little bit on Bill Webb. So if judging from the exhibition upstairs, he's clearly into baseball. Like, he knows pitch by pitch what might be happening, what the sort of like the mood of the game, what the drama that's accumulating. Is it required, do you think, to do what you do to love the game?
Baseball is a unique sport. A lot of the other sports are a little, you don't need to be a master of, you know, in order to direct them, like basketball and football and all the sports that go left to right on your TV screens are a little different to direct. Baseball is the only sport where all the points are scored away from the ball. It doesn't go left to right on your screen. All of the camera assignments change based on the situation in the game, how many outs there are, where the runners are, who's isolating each runner, who's staying with the ball in the corners if it gets cut, because our high home camera can't cover, you know, down the left field line and the right field line in the very corner. So are we going to break assignments if we get the ball hit in that corner? And it all has to happen in real time, and it's imperative that you have a camera crew that is on the same page as you and sticks to their assignment and knows the assignment. Because a lot of the times, I'm looking at the monitor wall, but I have to trust that those guys are going to be where they're supposed to be. There's a couple of them here tonight, so thank you guys for all that you do.
But I wonder, in terms of you doing what you do and being a big baseball fan and a fan of the team you're working on, then also being into cinema the way that you are, that seems like that could be the perfect profile for doing what you do, or it could also be maybe not, because you're too into the game or you're also too into the visuals.
You learn to speak baseball first. Like, before any of the bells and whistles can even be thought about, baseball is first. The game is king. Don't miss anything. Bill Webb taught me that right off the bat. Doesn't matter what you do, don't miss anything. The game is king. Baseball, being a Met fan really helped me when I first started, because I had this foundation of knowledge and fandom that I could bring to the table, because I started in the graphics department. So, you know, I had this, you know, lifetime of statistics and knowledge. And my best friend from high school, Ben, is here somewhere. And the poor guy, he's a Braves fan. I grew up in North Carolina. I made him watch a lot of Met games. And so that definitely helped starting out. And the baseball comes first. And Bill Webb taught me, unfortunately, don't be a fan. You can't be a fan, especially on SNY. You guys know we are a very unbiased broadcast. The go-ahead home run the other night the Nationals hit, I was able to take a shot of Lindor after he made the error, and took a shot of Tommy Hunter in the dugout after he hit two guys. Like, I'm not going to shy away from that. Like, I'm gonna give you guys, you know, what I'm feeling, because I have that foundational, you know, Met fandom in me, for better or worse. Like, you know, it's part, you know, there's part of being a Met fan that kind of enjoys the torture, I think, You guys all know that. And so I really try to dig deep psychologically and get in there where you guys, where I know it hurts so good.
I'm interested in the fact that you were such a cinephile film student without knowing that you were preparing for this. Like, I think about, like, when I was young, I was obsessed with film in every possible way, and film culture and film criticism even, but I had no notion that that's what I would wind up doing in any way. So why, obviously it was sort of like a retrospective, oh, I guess I was always meant to do this, but I didn't know at all. And it sounds similar for you. Like, once you started doing it, oh, right, this is what I need to be doing. So I'm curious about how you approached it before, like how you watched movies before doing this work. And then, of course, I want to know about how you watch them now.
Sure. No, I've always been a very visual person. I've had, you know, people like roll their eyes at me. Oh, John's taking the picture. He's got to get the background just right. Or, you know, you have your cinematic eye, John. Oh, okay. Yeah, let's take a step back, pal. No, I've always been a very visual person. Like, the movies that I love aren't necessarily the most narratively, like, you know, cohesive movies. Like, I love De Palma. I mean, he's just such a visual storyteller, and he speaks cinema so well. I love Dario Argento, whose movies make no sense, but God, they're so gorgeous to look at. So I've always been attracted to that kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And when I got the job, I didn't know that I would start implementing some of that, but I sort of did it subconsciously anyway. Mm-hmm. The way that I cut the sequences in my, you know, it's all about timing in baseball. Nothing, everything's live, and it's, I would, you know, when you're first starting out, you'd go back and watch the game you just did to kind of learn what to do and what you shouldn't do. And I started noticing sequences like, oh, that was really cool. That worked. I'm not sure I've seen that. I can't tell if I messed up there or if that is supposed to happen. Like, that was really cool. So it started there. And then, you know, I watch a ton of movies every year anyway. You start thinking differently. Oh, how can I bring this into what I do creatively? And you know, now I have a notepad of, you know, hundreds of ideas that I can't wait to do. And, you know, hopefully my bosses don't fire me before then, because they tolerate me. I know you all like me, but they tolerate me. I'm having a blast. It's so much fun to have the opportunity to do the kind of things that I do. Not every broadcast gets to do that.
Yeah. Do you feel like you need to love the standard form before thinking about how to break it or innovate within it? Or did you kind of come to it feeling that this was a bit conservative to begin with?
So when you watch a Met game or any game, it's going to be pretty cookie cutter, whether you're watching on ESPN or watching another, you know, Fox or whatever. It's going to be, there's a way to do a baseball game. You cover the pitch from center field, you cut to high home when the ball's in play. It's not that complicated. It's, you know, and I'll cover the game 95% of the way, traditional baseball. That's what fans expect, and I'm not going to veer away from that. That extra 5%, though, is what directors and producers all over the country, they have a little leeway to kind of take some chances and do things differently, and I really use every bit of that 5% that I can. I really do.
And really nobody else is using that 5% in that way.
Yeah, well, a lot of networks don't have the opportunity to, because at SMY, ever since I started, I mean, it helped that Bill Webb was there, because he got to do whatever the hell he wanted. I mean, he was just a titan in the industry, and he really opened the door for me to kind of be able to take the chances that I get to take. You know, when we're at home, we have the most incredible camera crew in the country. These guys do the World Series. These are Bill Webb's guys. And so they worked for him. They do the World Series. And they're so damn good at their job, mm-hmm. that they allow me to take the chances that I do.
Right. You know, yeah. That you're going to get the material. You're going to get
exactly.
The footage.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what we just saw. Like, you start off with, you know, the I think you're underscoring something that's already there. I think you're doing that throughout. You're not necessarily putting something onto the image that isn't inherent to what we're watching, but the way that you use the Westerns and the showdowns, that the pitcher catcher and the pitcher versus batter relationship is certainly a showdown. And I'm so interested in your relationship to Westerns, where your taste goes and what you like to watch, but then, yeah, a little bit about your construction of that showdown.
It's so obvious, isn't it? You know, the best confrontation in all of sports, and I will die on this hill, is the confrontation between pitcher and batter. It's so foundational to what the sport even is. I mean, obviously in the individual sports like tennis and boxing, those lend themselves to a very cinematic sense. But in baseball, the confrontation between pitcher and batter is the most important confrontation in any sport, in my opinion. And it really lends itself to the whole ideology of the Western for a lot of reasons, not only the showdown, just the Americanness of Westerns and baseball really kind of rang true for me philosophically. And it's just I'm a big fan. I'm talking about America, but I'm a big fan of spaghetti Westerns. I mean, but just because they're so overly stylized and you have the tight shots and you have the eyes, and it's, for me, it's all about the eyes. That's what makes baseball so special. It's because they're not wearing helmets, and there's a lot of moments of stillness, a little less now with the stupid pitch clock, but, you know, you're able to set the scene and build personal connections over these moments of stillness. Basketball's moving too quickly. Football, they're wearing helmets. In basketball, they score 100 points a game, so the points become less meaningful except for the last shot. Baseball, it's not even about the score sometimes. It's about these individual confrontations sometimes. It's not even, you know, there might be a matchup in a blowout game that has meaning, you know. It's you're able to, as a director and as a production unit, our group is able to build drama even when the moment doesn't necessarily suggest that this is a meaningful moment. Mm-hmm. That's the goal.
Yeah. And obviously you're cross-cutting a lot between, and you're live cutting between the eyes and the other set of eyes, whatever. How much have the image capturing adapted to that or evolved to allow for that kind of sequence?
How so?
In terms of, you know, the close-up, whether it's the close-up or the placement of the camera, like, has that changed at all to allow that kind of sequence, that kind of editing? Because that's not necessarily something, obviously you're bringing that as an innovation.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious if the shot making is also paired with that.
The sequencing is very individual to baseball because you do have the time. It all comes down to the timing because you're able to set the scene. You're able to lay out the geography of what's going on. You're able to shoot who's on first base. You're able to show the left fielder has a good arm. If the ball's hitting the gap, he's going to, you know, you're going to have a very dramatic moment at the guy rounding third base. It's not always just about the tight shots. The tight shots, you honestly don't want to overuse because you don't want to burn your tight shot on a moment that may not be the moment. And that's the thing about doing a live broadcast, is because I take a lot of chances with, you know, split screens and tight shots when I feel like this is the moment. And that's where the baseball knowledge comes into play too. Like, you know, the other night I did the thing you saw with it's the half dissolve with the clock in the middle. I had watched that pitcher throw three prior pitches where the clock went down to like one. He was just barely getting it off, and it was a big enough moment in the game that I'm able to take a chance and do something stylistic like that. And it's there's probably 4 to 5 moments like that over the course of an entire game where I feel like this is an opportunity to try a cinematic flair, try to build tension more than it already is just by staying on the center field camera. Because some moments are big enough that you can just hang on the center field camera, and you know that the moment is bigger than anything I can do right now. Sure. You know?
How has the pitch clock affected that in particular?
The pitch clock, I was so anti-pitch clock when it was talked about this offseason because it trimmed 30 minutes off of games. And as you guys know, SMY, that 30 minutes is where we make our money, man. That is like our bread and butter, whether it's the booth doing whatever the hell they usually do, and, you know, or, you know, me doing my wild stuff. It's like, that's where we really, you know, thrive, you know. No one does the game better than us. We got the game, the nuts and bolts, the X's and O's, we got down, but it's that extra stuff that we really, you know, take it to the next level. And I was really afraid of losing that. I've been pleasantly surprised that the clock has certainly impacted us, but we already moved so fast as a broadcast from a production standpoint that it hasn't really tethered us down like I thought it was. And it's been interesting too that although it's a total mechanization of the game by adding a clock, and it kind of takes away from the poetry that you had from the game. Was, you know, a game that, you know, may not ever end. You know what I mean? It's and we had some games nights like that.
Which, for those of us who love the game, that's what's amazing.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
Others, it's a, yeah.
Exactly. But the umpires are still in control, and it's I like that the umpires enforce the clock differently, go umpire to umpire. I see it every single night. Guys are either quick and they're like, you know, tyrants with that clock. They really are. And it's hard for us at SNY because, unfortunately, we have to get commercial breaks in. I'm sorry that we have to. I have to get paid. Gary, Keith, and Ron have to get paid. Good God. we have to run commercials. And we get back from break, and it's like half the time the pitch is like out of the pitcher's hand. It's very jarring for the viewer, and we're doing everything we can to adjust to that. But it really is in the umpire's hands when he starts that clock, when he stops the clock. And I like that the umpire is still in control. I'm pro umpire because I'm all about the humanization of the game. Once you lose the humanity, you lose so much of what we love about this game. The umpire, you know, the individual strike zones, you know, managers complaining, batters complaining. Once the game becomes robotic and more mechanized, you're going to lose a lot of what we love about the game. And I am so anti robot umpires, and because each umpire is different. You know, when you have CB Buckner or Angel Hernandez behind the plate, it's going to be high drama. That's the villain for the night. Like in my movie, that's the villain, and I really embrace that. And I know you guys hate them, but you hate them because I'm helping you hate them, you know.
When you think about it, one of the first great innovations of broadcasting live sports was the slow motion, mm-hmm. right? Or the instant replay. And now that's become the tool for kind of making sports a little more annoying in gameplay.
Yeah.
This is a broadcast innovation that's then become essential for getting things right to the centimeter.
Yeah, the replay mechanics are a little – it's something that's just awful. You know, it's not necessarily the time that it takes the umpires to make the call. It's the fact that every great play, every close play, there's a moment inside you that says, oh, maybe it's not safe or maybe it's not out. And that sucks. You know what? A guy just made a great play up the middle and, you know, the umpire calls him out at first base. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. Now I have to go, all right, camera three, go shoot the phone. All right, Eric Chavez is on the phone. Okay. All right, is he going to do a hand signal to Buck to see if they're going to challenge? Oh, earmuffs. Okay, earmuffs. And then Buck, okay, earmuffs. Okay, the umpire says, all right, earmuffs. And then it's just, it's literally the least cinematic thing we could do. So it's, they got a lot of work to do in that category, but they want to get it right. So.
And your images are what's being used to dissect.
Yeah, it's a lot of the Mets replay person, Harrison, has gotten a lot of accolades for how great his percentage was last year. His percentage was so great because he's got the best camera guys in the world getting the best shots ever for him to make these calls. So I give Harrison crap for that all the time. He's an NC State guy too, so I like Harrison. But yeah, so that's sort of how that dynamic works.
I'm interested in, and I'm going to get a little, you know, film theory here just for a second, because I'm thinking about point of view and how I think that the sort of standard approach to filming a baseball game, there's sort of a God point of view. Like, you're not, you know, you're outside the field of play. But now we're entering the field of play, and through a lot of what you're doing in terms of the close-up, the tight shot, we're sort of implying something psychological and personal. And I'm interested in that evolution in terms of, like, it really does change the way that we inhabit a different point of view now.
Sure. Yeah. When I'm in the truck and looking at the monitor wall, it's cliche to say I want to put you guys in the best seat, but I don't want it to be the best seat. I want it to be a totally different experience for you guys watching at home. When you're at a ball game, it's one point of view. I have 20 cameras to give you guys an enhanced version of that. And it's, I don't want to give you the best seat. I want to put you on the field. I want to put you in the batter's box. We're trying to find a way to cover more pitches from non-traditional angles. I get torched on Twitter by people saying they hate when I cover pitches from behind home plate. I'm really just trying to jar the viewer. I mean, no offense, but your attention spans are awful these days. I'm as guilty as anybody too with my phone and, you know, watching sports, but I'm really trying to jar the viewer out of their seats. And it's putting them in the batter's box. It's showing them something different. It's not doing something just to do it. I don't take one cut just because it's, you know, cool. Every cut I take is with purpose, and I really have to remind myself of that. And you know, when I cover pitches for behind home plate, it's for a reason. Don't get mad at me.
We also put us in Max Scherzer's eyes.
Yeah. I did do that. Sorry.
That's not a, well, no, it's fantastic, but it's not a point of view I'm used to seeing.
Sure.
Nor is anyone. I'm interested in the preparation involved. This is live broadcast. At the same time, you're doing things that require some bit of preparation. And you said you've got a list of things that you want to try. And what is that preparation like? How do you prepare to make a choice in the moment for something so innovative?
Yeah, the good thing about baseball is that you can play every day. The bad thing about baseball is you play every day. You know, not everything we do is going to work the first time. And so, you know, you always have tomorrow. But it really is a collaborative effort. I have a technical director. So I don't, in the video that at the end when you saw me in the truck, there's a guy that sits to my right that, you know, I say ready to take two. He presses the button that says take two. And he's a super creative guy named Seth Zwiebel, and he is my partner in crime. I come up with the crazy ideas. I show him a clip from a movie, and he is able to kind of construct it within the switcher, the device that he uses to cut cameras. And he's a super creative guy, and he's totally embraced everything that I've brought to him. And we're a good team. Like we have he's eager to see what I have planned next, you know. And it's sort of that kind of relationship. It makes it fun to show up at the truck every day, you know. In the dog days of summer, when the team is at, you know, that hasn't been the case recently, but when the team's out of contention, you know, you need something to look forward to, and that's certainly one of the things that we do.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what, in particular, say, the split screen, mm-hmm. you know, or something that's happening during action. Like there's actually this is too recent, but the recent play from a couple days ago where it was you basically did a split screen during the play itself.
Yeah.
So there's the guy the fielding play was being on the right side of the screen and then dissolved into the left side of the screen where the runner is running home for a second, basically. That was being you basically presented that live. That's not a replay.
Correct.
So what kind of preparation goes into that?
You gotta pick your spots. For that device to work, you need a ball in the gap to right field, and you need a fast runner at first base who could possibly score from first. I told our technical director, Seth, if we get this moment, be prepared to use the effect. I was calling it the ghost runner because he's sort of transparent. And so Lindor gets into a pitch, and he smokes it to the wall. At first, I thought it might be gone. Then I realized it's just going to be over the outfielder's head, and I go, oh, here's the moment. I said, ready, ghost runner. Hit your ghost runner, and he was ready. He put it in. And I thought it really worked. I got to kind of see if it's not perfect. I need to kind of adjust it and see how it evolves. But I'd rather try things in April and so that we're ready to have things perfect when September comes around, you know? And I'm grateful to SMY to, you know, let me take the chances that I do, because it's not like that everywhere else.
Yeah. And so in that situation, as you said, you're waiting for somebody at first.
Yeah, well, so that's basically anytime
fast runner at first.
Anytime you see anything that was in the video tonight, it's basically me telling you guys at home, hey, look, watch this, you know, because sometimes you guys know we're watching the game and you kind of just fall into the motions of the mesh of the game. You guys have seen 1,000 baseball games. You know how they're produced. You know how it's supposed to look. When you see something that looks different, that's me in the truck saying, hey, this is something important going on right now. I can't tell you that because Gary, Geith, and Ron don't shut up, but this is me talking. So it's my way of not only building tension but kind of signaling to the folks sitting at home, hey, this is a moment. Like, you know, I'm trying to heighten this moment, but I want you to perk up in your seat a little bit. You guys need to be jarred out of your seat every once in a while. You don't want you to sink too deep into your couch, you know?
And the Gary, Keith, and Ron don't necessarily know that you're about to do it either, so they're reacting.
They have no idea what goes on in the truck. about once a week, Keith will go, wait, what is that? What did you just say? It's like, Keith, you've been in the business for like 25 years now, longer than you played, and you don't know what the simplest TV term is. The best part about our booth though, is they're able to handle everything we throw at them. We don't have a lot of meetings. We have some. We don't have a lot of meetings. We don't do a lot of pre-production because we want everything to be genuine and feel real and in the moment. A lot of broadcasts will spend the first, you know, from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock just going over everything that we're going to see during the game. We choose not to do that because we want genuine reactions from the booth, whether it be something serious or something funny. And we want them to react in real time and see it for the first time, just like you guys are seeing it for the first time.
You did something last weekend, I think it was last weekend, where – at the Dodgers game, you brought them outside. You brought them basically to the top of the stadium.
Yeah.
So that, which I love because if you've ever been to Dodger Stadium, you realize there's nothing like this. There's nothing like this stadium. It's sort of physically situated different than others. It's sunk half in the ground. You see the sort of palm trees in the outfield, but there's a parking lot in between, whatever. Like, you basically put them in that spot so that they could talk about this physical architectural space.
Yeah, they're so good at that stuff, too. Like, that's going back to saying, you know, they can handle anything we throw at them. Our producer, Greg Picker, is a super creative guy, too, and he loves getting them outside the booth and interacting with fans. You know, in Pittsburgh, we've done the Clemente Bridge. In Miami, earlier this year, we did an open in front of the sculpture. Anytime we can get those guys out of their comfort zone, it's a good thing because they're so damn good at their job and they're going to come up with something golden no matter where we stick them. Yeah. But it keeps it fresh for the folks at home too, you know?
I'm a fan of when they just get into sidelong conversations about music and punk rock and the 70s and stuff. I can listen to that all day long. I mean, I grew up a Yankees fan. So watching,
boo.
You know,
I know.
It's New York. Come on. listening to Phil Rizzuto like go on about some random thing in the middle of the game, and like you come to love that. Sure. And I think them, they're so good at their job, but they're also able to go into those directions. And I wonder if you kind of react to that ever. How much are you responding to what they're doing?
Yeah, it's 50-50. So like I'm listening to program production, the live audio. Our cameras are listening to it too. So they're following our stories, but I'm also following theirs. It's sort of two parallel lines. You know, you don't want to stray too far from what they're talking about, but you can also lead them to places that you want to go as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think last night they were on some sort of tangent, and I saw Justin Verlander come out of the dugout for a second. I took a shot of Verlander, and they were like, oh, Justin Verlander's back after pitching a game in AA today. So that kind of thing, you can kind of we've been together for so long. More times than not, I know where Gary's going before he knows. So I'm able to kind of jump him a little bit and help him with where he's going to eventually end up.
Yeah.
Keith, I have no idea. There's no telling what's going to come out of that. There's literally no telling.
I'm a big fan of the Twitter with the cat photos.
Oh, God. Don't get me started with Haji. It's going to be a bad day whenever that cat dies, by the way. Keith is going to be a hot mess.
Don't even say it. God forbid.
He ain't getting any younger.
I know. a lot of what we saw here was, you know, narrative film based in terms of the stylistic formal movie, but also you're also daily documentary filmmakers too, and one of the sort of, you know, conceits of documentary film is kind of the real person who's a character, and I'm interested in building how you build characters of sorts over the course of a season, and who are those, who are the compelling characters and why?
Yeah, absolutely. You start the season, you don't really know who it's going to be. Last year, I mean, Edwin Diaz became a sensation like we haven't seen before. I mean, obviously part of that's what he did on the field. He had an incredible year, but it was kind of this, you know, not only baseball story, but nationwide story with the way he took the field and the way we covered it, it had legs that, you know, I couldn't believe what was happening. And it's moments like that, you know, that you don't really realize in the moment until it's happening, oh, this is becoming the leading man in our story for the season, you know. I don't know who that's going to be this year with Diaz gone. It's a huge loss for the Mets and obviously a huge loss for our broadcast just because of what he brought to the table. As an entertainer, not only just a baseball player, but it makes it hard in April because it's hard to identify exactly who that's going to be. Is it going to be Verlander when he comes back in May? I don't know. I guess we'll find out in Detroit. But it's going to be it's always interesting to me to kind of check back in around the All-Star break and see who's going to be the leading man in our little story that we tell.
Who, before your time, do you wish you could have spent a year or several years or a career filming as a character?
Player? Yeah. I'm a child of the late 90s, early 2000s Mets, and so Piazza was my guy, and so he was a rock star, man. He was everything to this team and this club, so he would have been my number one. But if we're talking grand scheme of things, I mean, you got to go with the franchise. I mean, what if Tom Seaver was pitching today? Like, what would that be like to have that kind of guy, you know, going out there every fifth day, you know, pitching nine innings. I mean, I wonder, I mean, who knows what he'd beat if he pitched today. He'd probably go seven. That'd be like, whoa, that's crazy. But, yeah, I mean, you got to go down the list of, you know, hey, those 80s Mets. I mean, I was born in 87, so I missed the 86, you know, troublemakers. That would have been some movie. On that plane, I've heard a lot of stories that I can't share. That's a movie, that 86 team. So,
but not, you wouldn't have been able to show it in your current job.
Well, you pick my spots, and you never know. I like to take chances, Eric.
No, I really wish you could go back and do that. I would have liked to see what you would have done with Turk Wendell.
Yeah, he was a good one. Yeah, that, he's a real maniac. Yeah, with the bear claw necklace and all that. Yeah, that would have been good.
Yeah, I feel like in the dugout, there's something to watch.
Brushing his teeth, eating the black licorice. Yeah, that would have been something. Yeah. Slamming the rosin bag. He was at the Mets Old Timers Day last year, and he did the whole rosin bag thing. It was great.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was awesome.
That's great.
That was fun to do. I got to direct that and kind of, you know, do a game with Mike Piazza, which I haven't done yet. So
that's great.
That was cool for me.
Who was the guy who was the anti-pitch clock pitcher that the Mets had for a long time?
Anti-pitch clock pitcher. Oh, Steve Traxel. You're talking
Traxel,
about the guy that was a human rain delay. Yeah, yeah. He would not have done well with his pitch clock.
Yeah. Okay, one question, last question for me, and then we're going to go to the audience. But I'm, you know, we saw that clip at the very end from the booth, and if you've seen the exhibition, you see Bill Webb do this. Editing with your mouth. I'm so interested in how you edit with your mouth and how you, like, you then put this together for us tonight, which you, I assume you didn't do it verbally. But I'm interested in how you adapt to that, basically where you're making every cut happen with what you say, but not with your hands. Mm-hmm. And you're also prepping a cut, a beat before that.
Yeah, it's the same philosophy as any editor sitting at a laptop or a deck or whatever they're editing on. The same instincts and the same rules apply to cutting live as editing. You know, you don't want to do too many jump cuts. You know, you want to let the motion lead you to the next shot. But I always thought I was going to be a film editor. Actually, when I graduated college, before I got this internship at SMY, that was the plan, is to edit, and you know, that came very naturally to me as a storyteller to be the one kind of guiding the audience and getting reactions with just the cut was really exciting for me. You know, it's a little different doing it live because there's no way to go back and change things. You know, you put an edit somewhere on, you know, Final Cut or, you know, any program to cut, they use the cut film these days. You can kind of run through it and see if it worked and show it to somebody, see if they got the reaction that you wanted. When I'm doing the live broadcast, I take a lot of chances that because of what I think's going to happen. You know, a guy makes a great catch in the outfield. I have a decision to make whether I want to cut to the pitcher for a great reaction or stay with the outfielder or go to the bench. There's multiple places I can go, and it's my instincts, it's the camera guy's instincts, and it's the ability for me to verbalize it for the TD to push the button. You know what I mean? So it's experience has helped a lot because you gotta get the reps. It's not a natural thing to be able to talk for 3 hours every night like that, like the way we do. And I got code names with camera guys. I got stuff that we're making up on the fly. There's guys that just know my style, my personality, and know the things that I'm looking for before I even know that I want them. Similar to what I talked about with the announcers. There's guys that know my personality that do 81 games with me, all our home games every year, that kind of know where I'm going, where I'm eventually going to be. They're the assignments that for the action. Every camera has their assignment for the action. What happens after the play's over is all up to, you know, the director, the camera guys, the producer, and wherever the announcers are leading us. So it's very collaborative, but the same philosophies definitely apply to live editing as they do for film.
Do you see it in your head a split second before it's implemented?
There's a plan. There's always a plan. It doesn't always work out. I mean, I took a shot in Oakland recently of a fan that gave the finger to the crowd. That wasn't on purpose. I don't know if you guys are up for that one. Thank God it was a late game. I didn't hear from my boss the next day, so that was fine. I love games in Oakland. There's just like, so like the people are so nuts there. So like, you got to be crazy to go to those games in that ballpark. We had a possum in our booth. Oh my God. That was an experience. What was the question?
I'm going to miss the fact that they're leaving Oakland. That sucks.
I am too.
Really
it does suck.
But No, if you're visualizing it a split second before it's being implemented.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's the ABCs of sports production where, you know, like I said, you know, you're covering the pitch from center field, you're going to the high home camera for the action. But I you brought up the thing I did with the runner scoring from first with the half dissolve. I have all of this game knowledge, but then there's a little column in my brain where I'm always thinking about where I can jump the viewer and give them something that they're not quite used to, whether it be a reaction shot from the dugout, something that our handheld guide gets on the field. You know, I really want to try experimenting a little more with our handheld camera guy, Pete Stendel, because he's one of the best that's ever done it, and we have the access, and he has the relationship with the players and the team that I think I'm able to push the limits of, you know, what we can get on the field, shot wise, and so that's definitely something that I am always thinking about. Yeah.
Okay. All right. In center, right here.
I'm curious about how rope games work. Do you travel with camera people? Do you talk to the local camera people? Can you influence them at all?
So we're going to do audio recording, so I'm going to repeat the questions.
Sure.
We're going to summarize them. Question about road games, and if you bring your own crew or if you're using a crew that's there.
We have a saying in the truck. It's that we thrive at home and we survive on the road. So how this works is we're kind of like the circus showing up the town. You know, we come in, we have an agreement with a truck company that supplies a truck in every city that we're in. But all of the technicians on that broadcast, whether it be camera guys, replay guys, stage managers, all of the people are local. We hire local people in all of those road cities. If you get a good crew, you can start to add a few flourishes here or there, but you're really just trying not to miss a pitch, miss something important, because it's not necessarily their fault. Obviously, a lot of the people aren't as skilled as our technicians are, but they don't know our broadcast as well either. So it's hard to take the chances that we do. There's some places we can do it, especially in division, because we visit those places so much, a little less now because of the new schedule. Can't wait to go to Detroit. Great. unfortunately, half the games, you're really just trying to not miss anything.
Which it sounds like it's like in some ways it's the B crew for a film shoot. It's like it's the local shoot, and you're not going to hire, not going to bring everybody. It's
totally
too expensive to bring.
I mean,
everybody.
I would love to bring our home guys on the road. That'd be unbelievable.
I have a naive follow up question before we get into this.
Sure.
Why is it a truck, and why are you not like in some facility?
That's a good question. Well, a lot of broadcasts are moving to facilities. Hmm. A lot of RSNs are doing their road games from studios in whatever city they're at.
Interesting.
And it's something I'm fighting so hard against, because we need to be in those cities. In order to do the games correctly and to provide you guys with the best possible broadcast, there are enough challenges on the road. We don't need to add in another layer. The studio, there's an inevitable delay. Everything that I say to the cameras that are on site, that just creates chaos. Mm-hmm. And with baseball, you really have to, I mean, every cut matters, the timing wise, you know. You're putting too much responsibility on the people on site when you're in a studio somewhere away from the ballpark.
Mm-hmm. So right here. Curious about the pushback that you might get from your bosses in terms of what you're doing.
No, totally. So I'm just giving them a hard time, really. But when I first started implementing a lot of the things that you guys have seen on this video tonight and you guys see every night, I was a little pushback because, you know, I'm working with a lot of old school baseball people that have been around for a long time. you know, but you know, it's a credit to them to see them kind of evolve with me and sort of embrace my creativity and the things that I want to do. When I first did the Buck Showalter Red Kill Bill thing last year, my boss came to me and he wasn't really happy. Like, he's like, what the hell was that? You know, I was like, well, let me show you Kill Bill. And you know what? And then the next day he was there and he came up to me, to his credit. And he goes, listen, I just talked to my kids and they said that was one of the coolest things they've ever seen on a baseball broadcast. And so, keep doing it, man. Just keep doing what you're doing. And then obviously it helps that we got all the attention that we got last year. Noah, who wrote the article in the New York Times last year, I think he's here somewhere. Noah here? Noah? Oh, there he is. Hey Noah. Thank you. Noah shined the light on our broadcast last year, and it kind of gave me more leeway to take more chances, to kind of see that I was being embraced the way that it was.
Sure. So. Yeah, that'll buy you a little bit more time. Okay, right here on the white.
My question is about your collaboration with your camera crew. You talked about your supervising producer, that's your technical producer, and how you're showing him ideas beforehand, kind of creating effects in anticipation of some moments. I'm similar how that works with the camera crew. Like, for example, with a 6-panel split screen where you have, you know, wide shots, you need to like pair those images, or for a split diopter shot where you have like someone.
Collaboration with the camera people in terms of what you're preparing to do.
Yeah, it's I don't mind surprising the announcers. I try to keep the cameras on the same page as me with what I'm trying to do. With the first time that I started implementing this stuff, they were kind of thrown off a little bit by it, but I really feel like a lot of the guys have embraced it and think it's cool. I mean, they've been doing the same job now. A lot of these guys have been doing it for 30 years. Jimmy, how many years have you been doing this? 45 years. So they've been doing baseball one way for a long time. And so I'm trying to keep you guys on your toes at home, but I'm also keeping them on their toes too. And these are creative people. They're technicians, blue collar guys, but they're really creative people. And they really are the lifeblood of everything that we do at SMY. And it's really a collaborative thing. And I'm so grateful to have them.
Yeah. I love that. Speaking of which, I love that in some ways, like, two movies that really you cannot copy because they're so insane and batshit in their own ways, you actually copied, which is Hulk and Elvis. Like, these are not things that anybody else would ever do, but you did them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Baz Luhrmann, he's kind of like, I got so many ideas from watching his movies, man. Because the split screen is something that it really translate well to sports. And when I turned on Elvis and I saw that 8-box split screen at the beginning, the first 5 minutes of the film, I go, oh. And so I took a screenshot. I drew a little diagram. I watched the movie at probably 7:30. The movie finished at 10 o'clock. And I sent it to our technical director, a text. I said, put this camera here, this camera here, this camera here, this camera here. And it was literally ready at the truck when I got in the next day. And wow. And timing worked out. And Diaz had a save opportunity that night. And I go, here we go. Let's try it. So it's as simple as that.
And the Elvis one with those weird wipes in the middle of the.
Yeah, he's such a showman, which I, you know, I'm always striving to be myself. So,
but yeah, please.
What do you do, Johnny, when you go to a city and you ask the second baseman, what are you doing here? And he says,
it seems like a strange question, but this
is
a
question about
before.
Camera, like, yeah. Folks not necessarily knowing the baseball lingo that you're using.
Yeah, we've gotten to some of these cities before where I'll be like, camera 5, give me the pitcher, and he doesn't know where the pitcher is. He's the little guy on the hill, that guy. You know, and it's a challenge, but that's where you have to kind of go from a creative person to making sure you cover your bases. You don't want to miss anything. This is going to be a limited, you're going to get very little from this camera. So you may have to lean on somebody else for tonight. You know, you have to, it's part of the job. It's not all bells and whistles. It's really, it's leadership, and it's making sure you know your personnel, what they're capable of in any given city.
And you also can't, as a you're managing, so you can't lose them either.
Exactly.
You lose an essential shot for the rest of the night.
Yeah, I'm not a screamer. There's a lot of guys in this business, and Jimmy will tell you this. There's a lot of screamers in this business, guys that just bury their camera guys and tape guys and, you know, MF them, you know, over the headset. And I don't believe in that because I don't want to lose them. It doesn't do me any good to lay into you like that. But this business has been filled with guys like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right here. Stripes. Question about the innovations making their way to other broadcasts and what you hope to see in terms of other programs.
That's the goal. I think Major League Baseball is misguided to view their games as anything but entertainment. I mean, they obviously were documenting what's going on the air, but it really should be entertainment. Like I said when I introduced the film, the competition's not the NBA and the NFL. You guys are choosing to watch SMY at 7 o'clock because you want to watch the Mets and you want to watch the broadcast. You want to check in with your uncle Keith and Ronnie and, you know, make sure everything's okay there. but I think it's really great for the health of the game to see other networks implement some of the stuff that we kind of made popular last year. I loved seeing what the Toronto broadcast did with their closer Romano, and I hope that it's something that I see from other teams do too. I don't know that we can really do it this year with our closer because there's only so much love I can give Sweet Home Alabama for Robertson. Although we made Simple Man cool last year,
Keith is such a heavy breather, isn't he?
don't get me started. This goes back to when I was talking about Keith has never. You know, acts like he's never been in TV before. It's like, Keith, this is a microphone. You can't put it up against your mustache. It's like he's seeing the equipment for the first time sometimes. So I apologize for that. I always have a little camera there, so I'm able to monitor what's going on in that booth. So when you guys hear it, I was like, oh, that's not Ronnie, is it? Of course it's not. It's Keith. You know, it's Keith adjusting his mic, Keith checking his phone, you know, his... Yeah, who's calling Keith now? But we have fun with it, and you know, we kind of embrace it. And we don't, you know, it's part of the show. Like this is the broadcast that everyone, you know, tunes in for, and so we don't try to stifle it. You mean, let Keith be Keith.
Well, when you said you like tune in for your Uncle Keith, that's exactly what I think of. Is him just somehow sighing into the microphone? Let's see, right here, in the jacket. About preparing for milestones that might be coming over the course of the season?
It doesn't really change the way we approach everything. We show up at the ballpark every day, you know, ready to bring the best show possible. If that includes something historic, so be it. It doesn't really change the way that I do things, although with the Kill Bill thing, the way that evolved is I tried it one time without the montage layered in, and it worked. It was cool. But it was definitely missing something, and so we sort of built, you know, this expectation that when are we gonna do it again? And I think we did it two or three times over the course of the season, and we didn't want to overdo it. We wanted to pick our spots, and the 100th hit by pitch was just so perfect because it was the third of the night, and Buck's reaction was just like unbelievable. Like usually he gives that gnat like that little glare that you guys have all seen 1,000 times. I take the shot after every hit by pitch. The guy that's an unspoken rule with the camera guy. After hit by pitch, I have 17 shots a buck from every angle. They know. So, but yeah, that sort of evolved organically, and it was really a fun part of last season. I don't know what's next. I don't know how we can top that, but we'll see.
Buck is a gift in that way. Further back here on the left. much.
Yeah, he. So, it's, you know, a few years ago, the big thing was let the kids play, you know, bat flips and something that the unwritten rules of baseball have forbade for a long time. God forbid you flip your bat. But I think that the fun of the game is trying to capture that, you know, that schoolyard feeling of Little League and what it was like to play as a kid. And I think they're missing the boat when it comes to what they're choosing to really embrace. Prior to this, I introduced the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings baseball movie at the Metrograph this afternoon. And I hadn't seen the movie in so long, but you forget just how fun the game is sometimes. And that movie demonstrates it so well. And I really wish the folks over in Chelsea or, you know, wherever their office is these days, 51st Street, they need to watch that movie because it really captures the sort of the spirit of the game and the camaraderie and the friendship. And the game is fun. The game is beautiful. The game is perfect, and it should be embraced.
Right here.
It's about reviewing what you've done and if it's successful or not.
It's honestly, it's sometimes hard to tell in the moment, you know, because things are moving so quickly. Once I take a cut and once it's on the air, I'm already three cuts ahead. Like I'm going somewhere else. So it's hard to tell in the moment. One of the great things about social media is after the game ends, I'll just go to SNY's like Twitter feed and they'll like post like all the clips and I go, oh, that worked. That didn't work. Oh, that was really cool. I didn't think that looked like that. So it's sort of new for me. Like I'm in the moment. And I know what's happening. But it's also hard to revisit it in that, you know, right after a game because it's so fresh in your head because, you know, I know where it's going. So it's actually better for me to like wait a month and go back and watch something that I did. And I go, oh, wow, that was really cool. Or like, I don't know if that worked. You know, it's you need a little distance from it.
Right here. Process of getting the truck to buy into the creative evolution.
That's the great thing about the SNY. I mean, and it comes across on the air. At no point was I ever told to stay in my lane or, you know, maybe you shouldn't try that. I was surrounded by creative people from the very beginning. I mean, even when I was doing graphics, even as a runner, I was kind of taught to think outside the box, and nothing I ever did. I can't remember one moment where there was something that someone told me, don't do that. Really, I seriously believe that, whether it be a graphic that I did 10, 15 years ago or, you know, a tape sequence that I did, you know, 5, 6 years ago. No one ever told me no. I mean, I used to do some crazy stuff in tape. Like, this is before you guys knew who I was. on Friday the 13th, I did all of the Jasons in Mets history in a sequence. And the finishing on Jason Vargas. And I put the Jason mask on him from Friday the 13th. And it's stuff like that that I've done throughout the years that no one's ever told me no. And it goes back to the way the booth reacts to it, because we don't show them everything beforehand. So when they see something like that, they react just the way you guys do at home. And they're laughing and they crack up about it. And so it makes it easier for people working in offices and wearing suits to you know, embrace it as well.
Give me a hard time about wearing a Yankees shirt, but this gentleman's wearing a Braves hat.
I know.
Much worse.
You're one of two Brave fans here. I know that for sure.
Back here.
Are
the players aware of it, and how do they react to it?
The players are definitely aware of it, for better or worse. Like I was talking about earlier, it's a very unbiased broadcast. So everyone's wives and mothers and aunts are watching the broadcast too. And if the guys in the booth have something to say that the players don't necessarily like, that gets to us eventually. I know for a fact that Buck knew about the Kill Bill thing. He had no clue what the hell it was, but I don't think he loved it. But that's kind of what you take the good with the bad. You know, we have a relationship with the team. We exist, you know, within the same stratosphere, but we kind of are our own thing, and we don't have, we're going to call it like we see it. And, you know, but as far as a relationship on the field, like the camera guy that followed Diaz in from the bullpen last year, our guy Pete, he had a great relationship with Diaz last year. And he, you know, after the first time we did the walk in from the bullpen, he, you know, went up to Diaz and said, "Hey man, we went viral, like, you know, a million views." It's stuff like that sort of allow us to push the boundary a little further the next time. You know, you plant the seed in a different spots, whether it be a player, a manager, front office, or facilities even, and you kind of harvest those relationships in hopes to improve in the broadcast.
How much leeway do you have in terms of sound capture?
That's something we're really actually trying to improve this year, because the sounds of and the ambiance of the game is so important to watching at home. You don't really notice it a lot, but you notice when it's gone, the bat crack, the glove popping. We're really trying to do this year, and this might be kind of boring, but we're trying to get that dead zone between like the shortstop and the left fielder and the second baseman and the right fielder. It's like a little Bermuda Triangle where the audio is not great. So we put out a bunch of new Parab mics this year, actually, to try to pick up that audio of a, you know, an infielder calling a ball or an outfielder calling a ball and getting that, got it, you know, that kind of deal. But that, no, we're super aware of the audio stuff, whether it be the ambiance of the game or music.
Yeah. Great. Right here. Any road ballparks you look forward to filming at?
Nothing photographs like Wrigley Field. It's just so beautiful. It's not super bright. There's like a darkness to Wrigley that sort of, if you can kind of feel the ghost, and I really kind of embrace that. San Francisco is obviously a gorgeous ballpark. It photographs nicely. Honestly, we just got back from Oakland, and we don't go there very often. I was like, despite all of the issues here, the grass is so green, and the field is so beautiful, and it's so big and vast, because there's all that foul territory. And so I thought that photographed really well too. But these ballparks, they're all gorgeously manicured now at this point. So it's not, you know, each one has their quirks, and we really like to kind of, you know, give the audience a sense of place when we go to these places.
San Francisco is so beautiful that I find myself looking at the harbor more than the game, which is strange. All right, I'm trying to get all areas of the theater here involved. Right here, please.
Yeah.
So a question about the storylines and preparing for that.
Yeah, we're you know, that's part of the good thing about doing a game every day, because you are aware of all the storylines very well. The specific thing you brought up, it's one of those times that a chance that I took that didn't work out. So the Mets called up their big prospect, Brett Beatty, which meant that Eduardo Escobar had to go to the bench. I took a shot of them pregame, and Escobar was trying to help him with his the pitch comm and kind of show him the ropes. And so to develop that story, I had him isolated with a camera during Beatty's at bat. Beatty got the hit. I saw Escobar react immediately, like, yes. When I took the shot, the celebration was done. So it looked like I was trying to, like, cause a little drama that wasn't necessarily there. So it's one of those things about live editing that didn't quite work. It would have been better in replay to show it that way. You know what I mean? To show the reaction. But no, we're locked in on most of the stories. If it's not me, then it's the booth or, you know, one of the other guys in our crew. Yeah.
Pitchcom takes a little something away.
I hate it so much. You know, part of the charm of baseball is the signs. And I used to love showing the signs. You know, it's, you know, you take a shot of the manager giving the signs to the third base coach, take a shot of the third base coach giving the signs to the hitter. We still have that, thankfully. But the signs at home plate, yeah, that's gone. That's
nothing more cinematic than watching somebody tap buttons on their knee.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's sort of taken away from a lot of the performance. If a pitcher's calling his own pitches and he's the only one deciding on what pitch to throw, and he doesn't have somebody checking him like the catcher or the manager, whoever's calling the pitches, I think it impacts their pitch selection in a negative way.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah.
Right here. Question about when other networks are covering the Mets.
Yeah, that's actually the reason why I was able to schedule this event tonight, because Fox was scheduled to do the game tonight. So it's useful over the course of 162 games for the national broadcast to take a few games here and there to give me a day off, which is actually nice sometimes. But it is hard once September gets here and the games get really meaningful and we lose the game. You know, they have the ability to just take the game from SNY, which is unfortunate, but that's just the way it goes. Those guys do a good job despite what anybody says. I know it's so hard in baseball because we are in your living rooms every single night and there's such an attachment to the broadcast and Gary, Keith, and Ron. And it's not just you guys. It's all RSNs. They have Joe Buck was the most hated man in baseball for years, and he's going to be a Hall of Fame announcer. You guys are so attached to your home booth, and I don't blame you. I'd be attached to him too, but
I'm not attached to my home
booth. I don't blame you there. it's difficult. When the games mean something and we lose one. Tonight, I didn't mind, because it was rain in the forecast. I was coming here to hang out with you guys. This was actually worked out perfect.
Okay, a few more. This is so, oh, wow. Okay, now the back is coming to play. Right here.
Nice.
How often do you come up with something on the spur of the moment?
Every day. I take 1,000 cuts a night. Every day I'm coming up with something new on the fly, trying new stuff that, I've never seen before. That's the great thing about baseball. At least once or twice a week, we all look at each other in the truck. Wow, I haven't seen that before. Baseball inevitably gives you something, a couple times a week where it's just like, wow, that's weird. And it's, that's never been covered that way. So I'm constantly having the wheels turning. Used to have more time to kind of take a breath and set the scene a little more before the pitch clock. Now it is a little more hard to kind of formulate those things and give them a lot of pre-pitch thought.
Right here. Being close to see some of these innovations that you were the author of in, say, in a World Series game?
I don't know about that. I mean, they have more assets and more equipment than we'll ever have at SNY. And so they have a lot of bells and whistles and a lot of toys that I'm super envious of. But in those environments, you really are trying to do a more or less cookie cutter show. You don't want to miss anything on the biggest stage. And so it's harder to take those chances. I'm not saying that it will never happen. The guy that does the director, that does the World Series now, his name is Matt Gangel. He's a fantastic director. He actually did the Field of Dreams game, which I thought was one of the coolest broadcasts of all time. You got to see the guys come out of the cornfields, and he's got all these cinema cameras, and I sent him a note after that. I was like, that was unbelievable. I would love to see that brought to a World Series game, the way that he was able to do that. I just don't know that there's too much money involved to really take those chances,
There had to have been a loaded ball for that game. There was like 17 home
runs. Yeah, totally.
Right here. Question about your current watch list and if any of those films might influence what we're going to see this year.
That's a good question. So you guys check out my Letterboxd. I have to go back and see what I just watched recently. I just watched Renfield. That was okay. I just watched the new Scream. I was okay. I always have my feelers out for what's out there. I watch a lot of like old Italian movies, Euro crime films, and I get a lot of inspiration from that stuff because it's just so stylized and over the top. You're able to get a couple ideas here or there. Today, I watched Bingo Long Traveling All Stars today, and it was like I saw a couple of like old school transitions. I was like, oh, that would be really cool in this moment. So I'm I'm constantly, you know, adding things to this list, and I have a few tricks up my sleeve for the rest of the season, that's for sure.
What's your favorite film of all time?
Favorite film of all time? Well, you saw it tonight. It's Kill Bill. It just came out at a time that was very important to me. I think I was 13 when it came out, and you know, I was able to go. I saw it in the theater probably 10 times. And Tarantino has been such like a gateway drug to like other like genres of film, whether it be, you know, 70s grindhouse or, you know, foreign films. And he's really his style is something that I really try to incorporate in the back of my head anytime I make a cut. You know what I mean? And he's opened doors and windows to cinema that have been it's a basic answer. It's a very like film boy answer, but he's a filmmaker that is it's really opened a lot of imagination for me.
I can't wait to see the foot fetishism making its way into the broadcast.
Our handheld guy Pete, he sold me a shot of a woman's foot in a flip flop in a flip flop hanging over the edge and like with the picture in the background, and I took it and I was like, oh, here's my Tarantino moment for sure. Yeah.
Just a few more because we're really putting you through it here. Right here in the middle.
Oh my God, that's a great question.
Stress dreams about work.
Oh my God, at least once a month, I have a dream where the entire monitor wall goes black and everybody can see the game going on except for me. And I'm like trying to cut the cameras, but the screen is black and it is awful. It's the worst nightmare.
That's fantastic. All right, here. But the shots and things that you wanted to be able to implement, but you couldn't.
It hasn't really happened yet. It's funny you ask that question now, because just yesterday we were talking about with my bosses the Nimmo thing where I cross dissolved him running over the action. He didn't really like it. He because it was over the action. You know, a lot of the flares and bells and whistles that I do are pre pitch, and God bless him. He's given me more leeway than I could ever ask for, but he wants us to revise that one a little bit just because it is over the action. I thought it worked beautifully, but actually, I told him and he had a laugh about this. I'd go, okay, I'll revise it, but I'm telling you, I'm gonna add it to my Emmy reel. It's gonna happen. Yeah.
I can't wait till you bring Bullet Time.
Oh yeah, that's coming.
Right here.
That was so cool, yeah.
Thoughts on your work making its way into different moving images.
I thought that was so cool. As soon as I saw that, I texted it to the guy, the camera guy that got the shot, and we had a good laugh about it. But the fact that I'm even being asked that question just blows my mind. It's so cool that you guys think what I'm doing is really neat. I'm just so over the moon that I'm able to even sit in front of an audience tonight with people that would pay money to come listen to me chat and watch the video. Like, this is like literally a dream comes true. And so like anything that happens after this is just like, it's the cherry on top, man. It's awesome.
Yeah. That's a perfect place to leave it, I think. But I because I asked the question, I got the answer. I thought that was going to be the answer, and I think I teased this to you in a previous conversation. But next time you have an off day and we have the room, the schedule, let's show Kill Bill 1 and 2 and have you introduce it and talk about
it. Heck yeah. I'll be there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Guys.